to see some serious shit.
2,500 tons of awesome.
The world is coming to an end. Today we face the monsters that are at our doors and bring the fight to them. You can finish this! Today we are canceling the apocalypse!
Pacific Rim.
Joining us now live from our New York studios is John Simon, film critic for the National Review and drama critic for New York Magazine. From our Chicago bureau, Gene Siskel, film critic for the Chicago Tribune and co-host of the syndicated television series At the Movies. And Roger Ebert, co-host of At the Movies and film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. All right, while it would probably be more fun to have you sling mud at one another, all three of you, let's talk about the movie nevertheless. Mm-hmm. Is it a great film? I mean, it's clearly great technology, and it does wonderful things with special effects. But in terms of the normal standards by which we judge movies, is this a great film? John Simon, clearly you say no. But why?
Well, first of all, you know, special effects are like the tail of the dog, which should not wag the whole animal. When you have a film that's 90% special, and that's a kindly estimate, 90% special effects, you might just as well be watching a animated cartoon, because finally all those special effects begin to look totally unreal. There is you're looking for something that looks like flesh and blood there. You have three lousy actors in the main roles who don't contribute much flesh and blood. You have ghastly dialogue, terrible plotting, miserable characterization, which also do not contribute flesh and blood. So what you're left with is something that Walt Disney could have done just as well with a drawing board and pencils and colors.
All right, Roger Ebert, beyond the undeniable fact that it's clearly perceived as entertainment by a great many people, how would you argue that it's a great movie?
These are the sorts of movies that Disney people should be making, and the kinds of movies that Disney made 20, 30 years ago. I think all movies are special effects. Movies are not real. They're two-dimensional. A film goes through the camera, the projector throws the light on the screen, and that makes a special effect. It's a dream. It's an imagination.
Gene Siskel, is it not possible to separate these two and to say, yes, there's such a thing as great entertainment, but it's not a great movie. Let's not pretend it is.
Well, you can say what its aspirations are. I don't think that a film should be rewarded for aiming low and hitting that mark, which sometimes in film criticism you do get that, the sort of junk movie as campy fun. I don't think this is campy fun. I think this is well-made fun.
And at this point, I thank you and Gene Siskel and also Roger Ebert for joining us.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Movie Moan. And what a wonderful edition it's going to be. What a wonderful week it's been for news. Because we've actually got some to talk about. We have the movie of the summer to talk about. And before we get to Grown Ups 2... let's get... Oh, hey-o! Hey-yo! Congratulations, Phil. It's the most obvious joke of the week. Before we get to anything, though, let's introduce the pilots of tonight's show, Our Minds Connected. For our first guest, at the moment, I'm only seeing flashing images of Febreze commercials and Chinese women. I'll let him explain what's going on. It's film critic for The Playlist and Jump Cut Junkies. It is Mr. Gabe Toro. Hello, sir.
My voice is currently breaking through some sort of spyware that's infecting my computer and presenting ads at a very loud volume that is conquering everyone else's voices. So I'm trying to block them out, but right now I just got an update as to One Direction's next tour. So I know that, and previously there was a Lady Gaga update, as well as some possibly Portuguese singing competitions. So I'm battling through all that noise to be here to discuss whatever we're discussing. I don't know. I'm hoping to discuss a lot of movies and a lot of movie topics today.
God bless you.
And hope is a powerful thing. You're a hero, Gabe. You're going to make it through it. It's fine. For the second guest, I see nothing but a sad child who's been left out of preview screenings for The Wolverine just because of where he lives, despite the fact that he's a writer for SuperheroHype.com. It's Mr. Spencer Perry. Hello, sir.
Hey, how's it going?
It's not fair, dude. I feel for you very badly.
Yeah, it was disappointing when I saw all the tweets of the people saying the preview screenings. But I was glad to hear that everyone seems to be enjoying it.
Well, it couldn't be worse, could it? I mean, I'm just keeping an open mind on it, but I'm hopeful that it's actually going to end the summer on a good note. And if me and Jamie were piloting a Jaeger as a tag team, I dread to think how much damage could be caused. Just by driving around trying to find the right turn down a street, I think we'd get into some trouble there. What do you think, Jamie?
I think the movie would be over very quickly. It would be like a 2-minute movie. Us getting suited up, like the big montage music, we get ready, and then like all of a sudden the entire fucking Jaeger explodes, and that's the end of the movie. And Earth is destroyed.
And for some people, I think they'd much prefer that, wouldn't they? Oh, there I go again with the burns. Let's get right to it, shall we? In discussing Pacific Rim, I'm reminded, surprisingly, of a quote by Roger Ebert when he started his television review of The Naked Gun. And the quote was this, quote, "I don't feel this film either requires or frankly makes possible a serious review," unquote. That's how I feel. Pacific Rim is a piece of comic book nonsense. However hard you want to look at the beautiful images it presents, they are not intricately layered with philosophy or allegory. They're layered with craftsmanship of some of the best technicians working in film today, and they're layered with fun. Fun from the maniac who directed it. And a week ago, I thought we were going to spend the whole podcast discussing this film, the characters, the individual moments, the content. And maybe the other chaps here will have a lot to say on that front, but I really don't. As far as the film itself, I can sum it up very easily. I think in terms of action and special effects, it is one of the most impressive films I've ever seen. I do believe that Del Toro brings something to the party here that other directors making this kind of film have struggled to do. When I say this kind of film, I mean the kind where CG characters collide and fight and destroy everything around them. Here, you do feel awe. You feel scale and you feel weight. You feel something, at least I did, and that's what makes me excited when I'm watching a fight sequence, when I feel the blows. There are about 20 billion blows in Pacific Rim, and I felt every one of them. In terms of characters and acting, it was atrocious. I specifically didn't say dialogue there because if I'm criticizing something, I feel that I should come up with a solution to that problem. I should try and come up with a better idea if I can. The dialogue isn't great, but I don't see how the characters could have said anything other than what they do in this kind of film. The issue for me is that the actors make some really weird choices with that dialogue. Idris Elba decides to shout random words in the middle of a normal sentence. Again, it's one of these things where, you can't criticize Idris Elba, he's so cool. I hate that shit. I'm sorry, I think he's bad in the film. Live with it. Charlie Day decides to shout everything. I can't stand him in this film.
He also talks fast.
And that too.
I'm a science nerd because I've got glasses.
Stop it, please. No impersonations. It's bad enough. And Charlie Hunnam, I'll let Jamie handle that one. But the only bright spark of the movie for me is Rinko Kikuchi as Mako. And it's only really because there is this one 10-minute stretch where I at least cared about her character. And it's when Gypsy Danger, the main robot, is going through its test run. And she has a complete mental breakdown due to unresolved childhood trauma, which almost kills everyone at the base. And it was the most exciting part of the film for me, because I know that Del Toro is actually crazy enough to let that robot go berserk and destroy the base. It doesn't happen, but what's important is that I believed that it could. But really, the most odd choice, and what I think really hurts the film, certainly in the first hour, is that Pacific Rim is a world builder movie. That is a film where the audience is being immersed into a completely different time and place with new rules and new terminology that we need to understand. So rule 101 is always to make one of the characters a virgin to that world, so we understand the awe of it all through them. The rules get explained to them. Here, every character is a veteran. Yes, the main hero, if you can call him that, he's being brought back into the Jaeger program after a few years away, but he still knows how it all works. He's seen giant bases and robots and monsters before, so there's this whole first act stretch where it's very pedestrian because none of the characters are the least bit excited about being there. And for those of you who might say, yeah, well, Del Toro wanted to avoid that cliche, I would counter, he uses every other one, so why not? I have more to say, but I will kick it open to Gabe, sir. What did you think of this one?
It's hard for me to talk about this because, I kind of feel like I had a little bit of a breakdown recently when it comes to these blockbusters, which is, you know, I think it's something that everybody thinks but no one really wants to talk about, which is, you know, when you're talking about movies and when you're talking about blockbusters, there's a tendency for a lot of people to grade blockbusters on a curve, but no one wants to talk about why, you know? And the fact is because, you know, you begin in these worlds where there's these invincible characters or these fantastical abilities and explosions and stuff, and you immediately, the tendency, I think, for an adult who sees a lot of really interesting films about real people and real issues is to dock it a point, you know? To say, well, this isn't really going to touch on any real emotions, real... So I think you go into Pacific Rim and to a certain extent you think, it's a kid's film, you know. Not really, but, you know, it's a simplistic escapist blockbuster. Now, one of the things that I find curious about these types of films is we're all willing to sign the social contract. And the social contract states that we know this is ridiculous going in, and we know it's not going to deal with real issues and real people, but that's okay. We're going to evaluate it based on that, based on other things. And I don't really want to sign the social contract anymore for a very specific reason. And I guess everyone else wants to, but I don't want to anymore. And I think it's just because this is the summer of endless massacre, of mass destruction, of these cities being destroyed. This summer, it's been overkill. I think maybe Man of Steel pushed me over the edge because hundreds of thousands of people die in that film. And we're seeing this trend where heroes stand over rubble and they say, we've saved everyone. You know, like that's gross to me, you know? That's like, it doesn't make any sense, you know? There is a scene like, Man of Steel where Metropolis has been 9/11 times 1,000 and Jenny gets out from the rubble and there's her and there's Perry White and I think two other people and the rest of Metropolis is now nuclear desert and she looks around and she goes, he saved us. That's right. Woman, there is nothing there. Everyone you know is dead. All of your friends, dead. Anyone you've ever dated, dead. The places you work, gone. This is like you've just been mushroom cloud. Why are you talking about who saved what or who saved who? No one would realistically do that. So Pacific Rim is interesting because, you know, it has these mass disasters, even this ridiculous violence. And I think Del Toro has enough imagination to make this look diverse, to make it look unique. To not make, you know, to obscure the fact that there are people here that are innocent people that are dying, and there's thousands of people dying on screen in this film, no matter what you tell me. Because part of the social contract, which creeps me out, is that people see these movies, and they see buildings being destroyed, and they assume, and when the heroes don't care, the assumption is, oh, the building is empty. That's the assumption. And I'm not willing to sign that social contract to say, oh, these buildings are empty, because these buildings are not empty. Let's get real. You know, there's nothing about people evacuating. There's nothing about these people saying, we should leave, we should get out of here. None of that. There are people in these buildings, and they're dying. So, and I'm not willing to, even something like Pacific Rim, where I think they treated better than most people, you know, I think Guillermo, this isn't the type of movie where you're going to be going like, oh, no, the people, you know. But if you're going to continue with this bloodless, crazy, violent carnage with no repercussions, then I don't, you know, I don't want to be comfortable with that anymore, you know? And Pacific Rim, you know, I don't feel any 9/11 echoes like I did with Man of Steel or Star Trek. I don't feel like, you know, they're trying to make you feel like this is a deadly important thing like those films. They're trying to make it seem like this is a fun escapist thing within the vein of Godzilla, maybe, that sort of thing. But, you know, it's just the sort of thing I don't want to see anymore. And I think judging by the box office returns of some of these films, particularly the last couple of weeks, I think it's a common thing. I think people are getting sick of this. I don't think people want to see this anymore. And that is a relief to me. And Pacific Rim is going to end up being a sacrificial lamb. It doesn't look like it's going to make a good amount of money right now. It's just a type of genre of picture that doesn't matter anymore. This sort of filmmaking, the problem with it is, you know, in addition to the immorality, in addition to the senseless violence, it's outdated. It's irrelevant. We've seen this already, you know? Pacific Rim, I'm watching this film and I'm thinking Guillermo del Toro, this guy's a visionary, you know, he's a great filmmaker. But Pacific Rim feels like something I've seen before, you know? And I think this style of filmmaking and this style of action and fantastical violence and in urban or contemporary settings, it's outdated. And let me tell you, I just said all that stuff while there were 5 ads playing in my head the entire
time.
No exaggeration. They just ended and it's pure silence. Oh, never. I jinxed it. One just came in out of nowhere.
Well, you enjoy Subway that Club. While I move on.
They're selling a Subway Club. But anyway, I'm hearing you guys. Yes.
So, Spencer, don't take this the wrong way, sir, but you haven't been on the show long enough for me to gauge a feeling for the kind of movies that you love and the kind of movies you really don't. So I don't know, honest to God, what you thought of Pacific Rim. Do you genuinely like this kind of movie, or have you not been excited to see it from the start?
I would say, how would you describe this kind of movie? Would you say that it's a giant monster movie?
I'll tell you exactly what I'm glad you asked that, Spencer, because the attitude that I have to this kind of movie is based, this is the kind of movie, and the way that people talk about it, it's how we reacted to comic book movies in the 80s and the 90s. These days, because comic book movies, well, from my experience, most of them actually do try to have proper plots, to have themes, to have characters that go on journeys, and some of them aim even higher to have proper subtext. You don't think of it that way anymore, but back in the 80s and the 90s, if you had some kind of criticism about plotting, about character, about story, you'd always hear back the immortal words, "But it's a comic book movie. Come on, it's a comic book movie, come on." And this is the kind of movie that this is. This is the kind of movie where we're supposed to adjust the goalposts. And you could tell that right from the trailers. That's the kind of movie this is.
Well, I guess what I would say, and kind of going off of what Gabe said, and what I've heard a lot of people that didn't like the movie, their arguments throughout the weekend, is that even though it seems that Pacific Rim's, you know, main focus was to entertain the audience, I want to know why that's a bad thing. Because to me, that's what makes the movie work. And I'll be the odd man out because I totally love the movie. Like, I loved everything about it. And I don't know why, when a film's primary motivation is entertainment, why that's suddenly a negative mark on its report card.
I don't feel like that's really been the thing, though, has it been? I feel like, if anything, everyone's grading it on, not you, because, I mean, I've talked to you many times, you're a very fair, objective guy, But there is a feeling of, like, because we're buddies with Guillermo del Toro, we're going to grade this on a special curve. I mean,
yeah, I've heard that as well.
I mean, and you have, and you have not, Spencer. Like, I'm not, like, we're not saying that because, like, oh, it's our buddy who's here, haha. But I mean, I've seen it where from a lot of guys who are personally friends with del Toro. We won't name them, but we know who they are. And they're saying it's Star Wars in the Next Generation. And you're like, well, you know, if you weren't BFFs with the director, would you be saying these kind of silly things? If you really feel that way, that's fine. But do you really feel that way? No, I don't think that for a second. Go ahead, Gabe.
I would take that one step further. And Spencer, I don't want to seem like I'm starting a fight with you, but I want to wage a jihad against what you just said. you know, first of all movies, you know, what are we talking about here when we say all movies are, you know, this movie was meant to entertain? What movies were made to not entertain?
That's
all movies
question.
Were made to entertain, you know? The fact is, entertainment is in the eye of the beholder. Entertainment is essentially enjoyment in this case. And we all enjoy things for separate reasons, you know? But the, you know, what we enjoy is up to us. It's our prerogative, you know?
True.
So, like, for example, when I say, that I thought Man of Steel was an incredibly boring film, you know, that is sort of, you know, that is in the eye of the beholder. But to me, something by, like, Abbas Kiarostami, who is a filmmaker who makes a lot of films about elderly men smoking a cigarette and looking out in a window and then nothing else happens, that's more entertaining to me than what Man of Steel is. Because of the ideas, because of what the themes are, because of what it means. So I don't understand this whole, you know, and other people say this too, where it's like, I go to movies to be entertained, you know, like, why else would we go? You know, do we need to kill time? Is the weather that rough? I don't understand.
Well, I
went to Pacific Rim to be entertained too. I didn't go for any sort of deep themes or whatever. The issue is just that this is entertainment, but the disappointing thing is that it is canned entertainment. It is Guillermo del Toro wasting his sensibilities and doing spam in a can. You know, it's something we've seen before, many times before. Some of us are going to ask for a little bit more. And in that case, I will preface what I'm saying by saying that Pacific Rim is probably the most satisfying blockbuster of the summer. You could put that in the ads. It's still with a huge caveat that this has been a terrible summer.
So what I love about Pacific Rim is that it's basically... it's an amalgamation of every kind of, you know, movie I loved growing up, where, you know, it's a monster movie, it's a giant monster movie, there's robots in it, there's, you know, it's I grew up with Godzilla and Rodan and all that stuff, so to me this takes the things about those that I loved, adapts them into, you know, the modern context with, you know, modern special effects, and it was just... I was just totally blown away by it. Like, I know everyone's saying, like, you know, you guys included, but everyone on the internet is, you know, the characters are, you know, unmemorable and paper thin and there's not a plot. But I didn't feel that way because there were connections I had with, like, you know, small connections that started out with each of the characters, and then as the movie continued, they just sort of grew up, or, you know, grew with them, and the... By the end of the movie, I was into all of them. I going against, you know, what Gabe said, I wanted more of Raleigh and then Mako, and then, you know, unfortunately, I wanted more of Stacker Pentecost, but unfortunately we can't get any more of Stacker Pentecost. I liked Newt and the other guy, Dr. Gottlieb. And then, of course, what's his name? Hannibal Chow. He was fantastic. I would watch a whole movie about that character.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a lot of fun. I did have an issue with the actor, I forget the character, but the actor played by Bern Gorman, who was last seen in Dark Knight Rises.
Very distinct.
Very distinct face on this guy.
Yeah.
Peter Lorre.
It's driving me crazy trying to figure out where I'd seen him. Spent like the 90 minutes trying to figure it out.
Really? See, my buddy Dwight and I immediately, the moment he came, we're like, hey, it's Daggett's assistant. Like, just immediately.
Well, that's because The Dark Knight Rises on an HBO every week, but I haven't seen it that many times. But...
yeah, that is true.
God
every
damn.
Every. What do you mean every week? It's on now.
Is it? I don't doubt it.
Wow. 5 times a day.
I meant every Sunday
on the Dark Knight Rises Network.
That character felt like such a throwback in a kind of negative way though, it felt like Hollywood's ideas of nerds like 20 years ago, like, oh, nerds, they're totally like the, you know, obnoxious and kind of effeminate and overly British.
Well,
and
I think that plays into something the movie was going for, with that a lot of the characters were like...
That's a throwback.
Like, they were kaiju cookie cutters of characters. Like, the one that got me was the guy that operated all the computers, who was the character that I was like, I know that guy.
Was that Fisher Stevens? Who the hell was that?
No, it was Clifton. It was Clifton Collins Jr.
Oh, him like, again!
It was Clifton Collins Jr. as Rob Schneider.
That's right. I keep seeing that guy, and I keep saying, who the hell is that? He was the fashion police guy in the... No, not the fashion police guy.
Negan police
guy in Scott Pilgrim, and he was in Star
was
Trek.
In, Star Trek. Boondock Saints 2. That was where I recognized him from, I believe.
He was on...
never say that out loud, man. Spencer, but okay.
I'm ashamed I saw that movie.
It's okay. We'll
edit that part out.
No, I won't.
I'm kind of with Spencer on the performances, because, like, for the most part, I actually... thought they were fine. Like, they are paper-thin stereotypes, and in that regard, what's getting a pass, and that sort of goes back to one of my sort of pet peeves, was that this is getting a pass for what Michael Bay gets shit on for, which is playing easy stereotypes, and this movie is just as guilty of that, but granted, they're better actors, and I thought they were fine. I liked Bern Gorman's character. I like Charlie Day's character. I like Ron Perlman. In fact, I'd go one step further, Spencer, and say I could watch a movie with Charlie Day and Perlman together. Like, I thought they were really good. Although I hated the post-credit sequence. I thought that was crap. I was like, you know what? He's dead. It's a great jump moment. And then it's like, oh, but he's not dead. And he's looking for his shoe. Like, I just couldn't stand that. But, and I disagree with Phil on Idris Elba. Like, your points are valid on Idris Elba. They're absolutely true. But to me, he's the commanding presence the movie needs because he's likable and you just look at him and he does look like a leader of men and, like, he does have personality and, like, he makes up for what is really the two of the worst performances I've seen in a major blockbuster in years. Charlie, how do you pronounce his name? Hunan?
Hunnam.
And
Hummus.
And Rico Kikuchi are fucking terrible in this movie. And I just sat there going, they're going to be better. And, like, I don't have any beef against either one of them as actors. I've actually never seen Charlie in a movie before. I don't watch Sons of Anarchy, and I think I know he was in other stuff. So this was my introduction to him. And, I mean, maybe what probably hurt it was from the start was that terrible voiceover where he just sounds like this every time. He sounded like Lunch Lady Doris. Like, I thought, like, that was what we were going for. I don't know, man. And, like, Riko Kikuchi playing the stereotypical Japanese girl who's shy, but, oh, she knows martial arts. And I don't know. I just didn't – man, I really wish the movie was about Idris Elba. Yeah. And I'm not even one of those people that's into, like – that's this big thing on the internet about
– Sorry, Jamie. You can't say she's stereotypically her own race. She's Japanese. How is she not supposed to be Japanese?
I'm trying to figure out what he was trying to say there.
If it's like the stereotype.
She comes on being all Japanese, you know, it's...
Look, can you do it less Japanese? You know what I'm getting at, though. It's
I suppose, well, there is that, I do admit, there is that bit when she's in the robot about to land a blow, and then she speaks in her own language, and it's that, literally, it's that kind of thing you get in an anime.
That was one of the best moments.
It was cool, but it was still...
Actually, I liked her intro, because I thought, like, I was thinking, like, oh, is she going to speak in Japanese the whole time? That would be awesome. Like, if they... It was like, this is ballsy. Like, they're going to give her performance, and, like, she's going to just speak her language the whole time, and we know these characters are smart. They all know Japanese. In this environment where, you know, it doesn't really,
we're all a part of the same Earth. So apparently, like, during the how many years of this war's been going on, like, we basically learned each other's language. Like, we all know Russian. We all know German. Like, it doesn't matter. We're all fighting this battle against these fucking monsters. So we'd learn each other's languages just to communicate more. And that was one of the things I did like about the movie, was the world united, except for the one Australian asshole, of course. But but he learns his way, you know. He's young and brash. But his dad's even like, oh, he said, my son's an asshole. I can't believe he's mine. And that kind of nonsense. But, man.
Does explain why he's not too miffed at the end when his son's dead.
Yeah, that's so weird. Like, everyone's cheering. It's like, yeah, but, like, they died. Like, just, what are we talking about? You know.
A good death is its own reward.
That's.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm golf course. If you want me to, Gabe, if I can just before Spencer comes in, I would just like to put you to task a little bit on the Man of Steel point. It's an extremely valid comment, but the eagle-eyed people who've seen the movie 5 times will tell you that when Superman and Zod move on to their final fight, they move on to the 15 blocks down the road that haven't been destroyed, and there are plenty of people alive there. They're watching them from their cars. So there are people alive, and then they get killed when they start ramming themselves into oil tankers and buildings. But they were alive for a minute there. So Metropolis isn't completely destroyed. It's just a good 15, 20 blocks worth. But that's a small point.
Piggybacking off of that is that, you know, I agree, Gabe, that not all of the buildings are empty in Pacific Rim, but they do go out of their way to show two of the larger ones are empty.
Yeah. I didn't mind that.
And then there's the whole thing about what's his name, Stacker Pentecost saying, well, we have to evacuate everybody, get them in the shelters, and then they show everyone going into the honeycomb shelters underneath Hong Kong. So, yeah, people probably died, but they're at least taking measurements to prevent as many deaths as, you know, Man of Steel.
Yeah, and the fact is, this has been going on for years.
Yeah. I wonder why people still own cars in this universe.
That was another cool thing about the movie, though, was that it was something that was going on for years. Like, it's not just like Independence Day, where it's like, over the span of, what, 4 days, we had alien, you know, first contact, destruction, a holocaust, we come back, we destroy them, the end, we cheer, that's it. You know, it's just...
Or even worse, Jamie, to give you a worse example, World War Z, where this is just the beginning. See you in 2 years. No, you won't. You know, it's not
only that, but yeah, we cured it. We stopped the virus. We have a montage where we figure it out and win. Oh, but it's not over.
It's not over.
It's not over. It's like that, like, Simpsons joke, like, drink Duff responsibly.
Terminator Salvation was the worst for that. You destroyed it. You spend the whole movie telling us if you pull the plug, if you blow up Skynet, it's all over. And then at the very last voiceover you say, well, it's not over. Fuck you!
I feel terrible. I told McGee that once.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Awesome!
You told me about that. Yeah.
He's such a sad puppy, this guy. He's so desperate for approval. You know, sweet guy, but, like, you know, you could tell he was, like, he probably took on Terminator Salvation because he's been known for all this silly stuff, and he was like, you know, validate me. So, you know, we were talking about Terminator Salvation, and he's like, well, you know, we tried this, it didn't work, we tried that, it didn't work, whatever, you know, but, if, you know, I would have liked to have done a sequel, and this was 2 years later, so he said, if there was trailers for a new Terminator movie with Christian Bale, which he was suggesting that he would do it, but he said, if there was another Terminator with Christian Bale and you saw a trailer and it was coming out this summer, you'd want to see it, right? Right? Would you? I didn't realize he was actually asking me.
Yes, Spencer, right? Don't you want to see it? Come on.
And I was like, well, not really. And he was like, why, can you tell me why? And I said, the thing is, you know, you're setting the table for the Terminator universe, but all the films have so far advanced this and kind of played fast and loose with the rules and introduced new ideas and new concepts. And this film, you know, it kind of ends exactly where it ends. There's no advancement whatsoever. So, it, you know, all the films took a role in advancing and changing things and exploring the paradox, and this film had just kind of, you know, the story is kind of redundant, so no, I wouldn't be excited. And then I realized I'd done this for like 3 straight minutes to him on the phone. And I felt like him kind of like take a deep breath, and he was like, I heard his voice crack a little bit, and he said like, that's fair. You know, this felt, Pacific Rim just felt more of a, you know, it felt like very good spam in a can, you know? Whereas those films are their own thing. This felt like, you know, him playing the studio game, and it's Warner Brothers, and it's a big blockbuster. I think it's very disappointing how this is the same old song and dance viewed through the prism of a filmmaker who, you know, if you were to look at the past history of Del Toro, he's been trying to set up studio efforts for a very long time. You know, by the time he got to Pacific Rim, he was probably like, screw it, I'll do whatever you want. You know, how many things have been shut down on him, you know?
But does that speak to, like, is that a problem with him, or is it that just he just has that much bad luck? I mean,
it's a problem with the studio system. It's a problem with the studio system, especially because, you know, they say, oh, this guy's a really talented filmmaker. We'd love to bring him on board and tell him what to do. Like, it contradicts.
Well, himself. Yes and no, but then we look at all the movies he turned down, and you go, like, why'd you do that? Like, you know, it's like, you know, he turned down infamously, like, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. He turned down Chronicles of Narnia, Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. You know, it's like a lot of other movies. He just like shot down, didn't want to do them. And like, I respect that, but at the same time, it's like, here's like his way of filmmaking, his mannerisms, his own isms would have probably made them a lot better movies. Now, I'm not going to say Prisoner of Azkaban, that's sacrilege, and even I don't believe that would have been a better movie. But you know, imagine him making Narnia.
We were talking about comparisons before, and actually, I do want to mention this, two films that immediately sprung to mind when I was watching Pacific Rim yesterday. One is very obvious, one not so obvious, but both are important for me as far as people's reaction. The first is Avatar, that's the obvious one, because Pacific Rim to me is its successor in terms of being a world builder, in terms of its technical achievements and its craftsmanship, in terms of showing me things in its action sequences that left me genuinely impressed, which is very hard to do, and in terms of having really good 3D that I do think did contribute to the experience, at least in the showing that I saw. And to be the next Avatar, that's a trophy that studios have been trying to chase for years, and I think Pacific Rim is the one that takes it. Can you imagine if this film came out in 2010, right after Avatar, what would have happened? However, if you think Pacific Rim is a better film than Avatar, then I would love to have a debate with you, because I think you're wrong. The other film that it bears comparison to me is Speed Racer.
Yes.
In terms of being a living, breathing Japanese anime that could give two shits if you get it or not, if you don't get the influences and the references, you know, that's your fault. If you do, it's Candyland, but if you don't, or if you never cared for anime, then the whole thing just looks unbelievably stupid. Again, if you think Pacific Rim is a better film than Speed Racer, I would love to have a debate with you, because I think you're wrong. Yes, folks, I love Speed Racer, flaws and all, and I prefer it to Pacific Rim. Eat me.
I think all four of us here love Speed Racer.
Yep.
Gabe does too.
You sure about that?
His silence is his way of saying, I agree, Jamie.
To further your point about comparing it to Avatar, though, I would say that, like Avatar, it's constructed from all these other storytelling tropes that have been around for years, to which people will say is a bad thing, but the reason that they work in, to me, the reason they work in Avatar and the reason they work in Pacific Rim is because they may be old and tired, but the reason that they're still around and people know them is because they work.
Yes.
And the reason that they work in those movies is because the people that are making the movie understand what they're doing and put it through a lens of their own craftsmanship.
Well, I also think the other important thing, as I was talking about before, is the fact that you're following a character, a main character, who's going on a journey to a new place that he's not seen before. It's incredibly important, and it's just, I understand why Del Toro chose to tell the story the way that he did were the fact that this is year 7 of a war that's been going on for a long time, and we've just adapted to it, and it's the norm now. That's incredibly interesting, but it still doesn't take away the fact that it would be nice for just one character in this movie to be new to it all. Just so one character can emote and say, gosh, golly, this is rather impressive, isn't it, chaps? I could have been the scientist. You could have had me play the Brit scientist, but I'm new. I've just come over from England where everything's still lovely. But I've decided to come over, you know, to help out the stupid Americans and figure out a plan, you know. And I could have come with a pipe. And yeah, that's the only thing that guy was missing was a pipe.
Oh, come on. Why did he have to have that American? I mean, maybe some of it, the fact that I didn't like the lead actor was like because he was sporting an American accent. I mean, he's British, right? Like,
he's from Newcastle. He's a Geordie.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. But like, I didn't. Would that have made a difference? I mean, it's so weird. It's
being easy on him, Jamie, because I'm just guessing here.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing it's just one of those actors who he's doing an American accent, and like a lot of actors, when you're doing an accent, you're just choked by it. You can't do anything. You can't alter pitch. You can't emote. You're just concentrating so hard on the accent.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, my thing is, like, they could have had an actor with personality and, like, charm.
Yeah.
Like, the command of, like, of Elba. You know, and for some inside baseball here, Tom Cruise was originally going to play Idris Elba. He was cast. It was like, oh, he was going to do it. Oh, he was up for it. I was like, no, he was playing the part and didn't do it for whatever reason. Maybe money. I don't know. But I'm fine with Elba. I really liked him in the movie. But, like, I mean, I could immediately imagine a lot of my issues with the movie going away with an actor like, say, instead of have Mark Wahlberg or Chris Hemsworth, guys who have personality. Like, put them in that movie. Maybe even Riko Kikuchi could have been better, like just playing off the actor.
I think that, and this is one reason that it worked for me more than it did other people, is that, and I noticed it more the second time I watched the movie, is that I'm a Sons of Anarchy fan, and when I was watching it this time, I noticed a lot of his mannerisms and the way he spoke were almost exactly like his character in Sons of Anarchy,
mm-hmm.
and which, you know, kind of lends a lot of credence to the argument of the people saying that he was a bad actor in the film. I don't agree. I thought he was good. I liked him. But it did kind of pull me out of it the second time I was watching it. Just the way he walks, like kind of holding his belt with one hand and then letting the other hand, you know, kind of swing, and his attitude, and like when he's fighting the Australian guy, it was all kind of like, well, this is what Jax Teller would be if he piloted robots instead of sold guns and rode a motorcycle.
I will say, like, the best thing, I mean, I don't think I've even gotten my what I think of the movie overall across. We've been talking about little points here and talking about, you know, McGee and all that shit. But I thought it was okay at best. Like, I just thought, like, okay, I mean, it's, I agree with you, Spencer, in that it is unapologetically a monster movie, and I can respect it for that. And they certainly tried to lay all the tracks down for, like, the backstory. And to me, like, that stuff at the beginning was great. Like, that worked. Like, explain the entire background of, like, everything that's happening here. And even the montage of, like, of the pilots becoming rock stars, basically, and then going on talk shows. Like, you see all these weird, like, Japanese and American and German
things that
news
would
reports.
Happen in the real world.
Yes, absolutely, and that was their way of making us believe in the reality of this world. Because it's still. But my problem is that it just. But then you get into those wacky suits, and it just. And again, this comes down to the actor. I just didn't feel the plight of the character, and it's just. It does kind of just, at a certain point, I didn't feel the monsters were that interesting. It's a Del Toro design. And I couldn't understand what the difference between a Category 4 and a Category 3, and at the end of the movie, they goes, it's Category 5. So, I didn't get this. And? Like, just, you know, go get some shelter. Get in your bathtub. You know, wait for it to run over. You know, I didn't understand that stuff. And it's just like, all the fights felt the same to me. It's like, it's a robot, and we're gonna fight. And the best scene in the movie, and this is where, like, and it's Del Toro at his best, and it's simple imagery, but it shows, like, simple good. It's why film as a media works. It's all about images, and it's the scene where they first test, what's her name inside the Jaeger, and she's having the flashback of, basically, of seeing a meeting, what's his name for the first time?
Stacker Pentecost.
Stacker. See, yeah, names are silly. And, but it's like it's a crying little girl, tiny, against a giant monster in an abandoned city. And those simple images, I mean, it's simple, but it works so fucking well. And it's like, this is perfect. It's so horrifying. And like the little girl they got, you wanted to hold her, like hug her, and be like, it's going to be okay. And I thought that was intriguing. And then the reveal of Pentecost, and that he's her father, quote unquote. You knew it was coming. It's not like a big plot. It's like, well, of course that's going to be the plot twist, quote unquote. But I thought like, that would have been a more interesting movie. Like, what if you are a pilot in the midst of this war, raising a child, and raising someone else's child as your own, in the midst of this unheard of event, and it goes on for years? That, in my head, was a more interesting movie than the film we got, personally, for me. That one little moment I extrapolated and said, God, that should have been the entire movie, right there. What is that like?
But to pick up your point, before, Jamie, when you're saying, I mean, this goes back to my thing there, you know, they're not explaining to each other what a Category 5 is because they all know, because nobody's new. If I'd been there new with my pipe, at least I could have said, by Jove, what's a Category 5? And they could have told me, and we would have been all right. And again, the other thing, I mean, I'd like to ask you this question, Spencer. I do feel it's another one of those movies. So many movies do this. It's hard to find an example these days of one that doesn't. Avatar is one of those, thank God. Pacific Rim blows its load, not to put a fine point on it, in the middle set piece. There is no way it can possibly top itself after the Battle of Hong Kong.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that the reason that the finale was still entertaining was that, and some people would definitely disagree with me, is that while you're like, okay, the two robots are going to go to the portal and try and get this across, but it takes on a different style of a fight from the middle one. So yeah, the one in Hong Kong is more exciting, but I was so interested in that one because I was like, well, how are they going to fight at the bottom of the ocean? And then at the end of, or you know, about halfway through the fight, where you're like, well, Gypsy Danger doesn't have a right arm and her right leg barely functions, how is she going to finish the mission? I don't know that I really answered your question, but that was how
it's like, say, it's a, how can we possibly judge, you know, what is fun? It's, you know, what is fun? It's like, what is it as a concept? how do we judge it? How do we rate it? It's all I feel. I mean, I do think that I am glad Pacific Rim exists. And you know why? It's not because it exists. I'm glad it exists because it once again is one of the best examples I can think of right now to ask some very hard questions that I think all lovers of film, all film pundits and all would-be critics need to ask themselves. Do we have double standards? Are we too darn snobbish sometimes to expect every movie to have subtext? Isn't it enough to judge a film on its own aspirations? There's a particular quote that I'm very fond of. Jamie and I are really, really fond of this YouTube video where Siskel and Ebert are on Nightline to discuss Return of the Jedi with this other curmudgeon critic who didn't like it. And Ted Koppel asks a very pointed question. He says directly to Siskel and Ebert, is it enough to just say it's not a great film? It's obviously great technology, but it's not a great film. Let's not pretend that it is. And Siskel said, I think you judge it on what its aspirations are. This is well-made fun. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable way of looking at it. The only problem is that my teeth were on edge every time Charlie Day opened his mouth. So I'm not having fun when these people are talking. If I'm going to have fun, I need to be having fun the whole time. And I fully accept, when they're fighting, it's incredibly impressive. And I was having huge fun. It's just not the whole package. That's all. It's not. Speed Racer is a really great movie about a family, and it actually has a lot of heart to it that people don't give it credit for, and I don't know if that movie is going to be appreciated and age like a fine wine over time. I've certainly seen no evidence of it yet, but the few people that I do talk to they're giving it its due. It's very nice, and it's nice that these people here do agree on that point.
There's no way of knowing what's going to be a remembered movie. We had that when Scott Pilgrim failed. People were like, "Yours, people are going to say it's Janus, and you're going to look stupid for not liking it." And it was like, well, you can't tell if that's what's going to happen. I mean, you know, Shawshank Redemption is still the greatest example of a movie that was a failure. It's still a failure, and yet, you know, it was a movie that immediately took to the public, and no one could have called it like one of the, everyone's favorite movie is about about two men in prison. Who become best friends. And you go, what's this about? And, of course, it's the Shawshank Redemption. Everyone knows that. You just can't call it, though. You know? I mean, like, It's a Wonderful Life was also a complete failure. And yet it's now the movie. And, Phil, I don't know if it's this way for you in the United Kingdom, but, like, the first Saturday of every December, it plays on NBC, and they also play it on Christmas Eve. That's a tradition that we've had for years. Mm-hmm. Decades, I think, even. But no one thinks, oh, it's a failure. It's just it lives past box office, and you can't engage what that's going to be. And some of that, of course, is the environment we live in, whether home video, while it still exists, it just doesn't have the same kind of impact anymore.
Well, we don't also, Jamie, I mean, how can you possibly compare the way that people talked and word of mouth grew about a movie in 1994 to the way it is now? It's a completely different...
Well, that's what I was getting at. Yeah, that's what I was getting at in terms of, like, just the fact that there's no... Yeah, also, the internet had just taken off. But, you know, there was only, I don't even think... Patrick had opened Coming Attractions yet, so there was none of the movie news stuff to spread the word on.
That idea of word of mouth is kind of dead now. The word of mouth only exists for movies that still make a good amount of money. I think these days, just movies' strongest impression is being made that night because of all these social networks. You're getting a flood of immediate opinions to the point where an opinion reappraisal 8 months down the line is not going to get attention. You know, you see people make an effort to do this every once in a while. Like we're a year later and people are trying to make John Carter happen, you know. That's not going to be a cult sensation. No, it was a failure and most people did not like it. You know, you're not going to have the cult of John Carter and it's not going to matter. It's not going to be like Buckaroo Banzai, which was not that successful at the beginning, but was a terrific film anyway, so the word got out. Something like John Carter, whether it was good or not, the verdict has already been heard, and no one's going to be listening for a reappraisal. You know, that era doesn't exist anymore. The idea of word of mouth doesn't really exist unless it's a movie that's, you know, the word of mouth is so inoffensive that you can say, it's fun and it works, and that'll come across to people more than, like, you know, anything else.
And this idea also, I mean, I would have thought personally that it is impossible to have a cult film now that gets reappraised. For that to work, from my experience, it also has to be a film that isn't available. It's got to be a film that you might have heard about, but you never saw it. Nobody did when it came out, but somebody manages to grab a print of it, like Buckaroo Banzai or something like that, and then they put it on for you, and then you watch it. It's not going to work like that for Pacific Rim. If you want to see Pacific Rim, you can probably see it right now online, or you can wait like 3 months and buy it in October. The release window will be very short, I imagine.
Yeah, but like a movie like this, even though as mixed as I am about the overall product, I would even say, for God's sake, go see it on the big screen. This is a movie that does command to be seen in 3D too, because the post conversion is phenomenal.
It's great.
It's probably some of the best I've seen. And like, you know, I would say, yeah, totally go see it. Don't wait for video. Like, I'm not going to chastise people for seeing this, for seeing Grown Ups 2 over this weekend, because I understand why it did. It's and that comes down to marketing and another topic and Gabe decide.
I smell a segue.
Yes.
Oh, don't you sigh to me. You're the one who's wanted to do this. You'd make the choice, man, Williams.
I know.
He does this all the time, folks. It's like, well, it's just like, oh God, why are we talking about this, Phil? I'm going to see Grown Ups 2. Why are we talking about this, Phil? I saw Grown Ups 2 for you. Why are we talking about, shut the fuck up, you fucking hypocrite. What, I'm just...
This is 5 years of pent up frustration with me.
Seven.
Just coming all at once.
Seven.
Seven.
Get it right. So sick. How
there,
is
there it is. It's just angry even more. No.
You've really intrigued me. You've piqued my interest there. Yes. Nobody's heard it. What was Grown Ups 2 like?
It was in.
Thank you very much. Let's go into the news.
Okay, it is incredible. I saw it Thursday night because my local theater didn't get Pacific Rim, and I kind of thought there was a chance that like one would get it, the other wouldn't. We'd do a swap and trade, which we've done before in the past. We didn't. We both got Grown Ups 2, and I said, all right, I'll go see it. I go Thursday night, and like, you know, I've seen Adam Sandler movies. Like, it's weird because his comedies, only one or two of them are genuinely good. Like, you know, it's the same kind of humor, but like lately, and I don't know when this started, I'm sure you guys have, Spencer and Gabe have seen a few more recent ones, but there's this weird thing at a certain point where he just, I don't even know, like he just starts putting his friends in the movie, and I don't even mean friends as in his actor friends. He puts in like people who, like his kid's dentist. Or, you know, his best friend from high school who's got like a weird look and he just talks funny. So he says, hey, let's put him in there. And like, that's kind of cool from a personal standpoint. It's like, cause we've all heard stories about what a really good guy he is in real life. He's very generous with his money. He's loyal to his friends in front of and behind the camera. Yeah. And forget, it's this funny thing to say now, but he was fired from Saturday Night Live. Like, he doesn't talk about that show in a fond light anymore. Like, if you talk about it, he's very much like, fuck Lorne Michaels. I don't, you know, he fired me and Chris and all of us. He can go to hell. He's not a fan. But it's just funny. Like, he overcame all of these obstacles. And his comedies, while they're big now, were cult films. We talked earlier about movies being discovered on video, how that doesn't exist anymore. That's exactly how Sandler got to where he is now, because Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore were cult films that made like, you know, $10 million in theatrical, but they cost nothing, and they just exploded on video. So by the time he gets to A Wedding Singer and Waterboy, he built up an audience and was able to make these $100 million success stories. I mean, even though the movies got progressively worse. What's fascinating about this movie is this is an epic. It's not even a fuck you to the audience. It's him and Dennis Dugan and those writers sitting there in a room going, how can we keep tricking the audience into keep coming back? Like, they know it's garbage. And they know, like, this is basically an excuse for the studio to pay for us to all hang out and employ our friends and get free shit and a lot of money and product placement and all this stuff. And what's amazing about this film is that it's a series of scenes. Like, the first one, I understood why it was well-received because, and, you know, Phil, you saw it firsthand, is when we ran into my best friend Chip. Is I hadn't seen him in a couple, maybe about a month, and he immediately started giving me shit because, in a loving way, because, like, you haven't seen your friends in years, and you immediately go back to your old roles, and that includes giving each other crap. And, like, that's what that movie was, and a lot of people can relate to that. It's not a good movie. It's terrible, in fact. It's what's interesting about this movie is that it's just, like, every character in terms of, like, quote-unquote plot, it's two scenes apiece, so there's conflict, and then resolution. That's it. You know, but then there's so many characters in this movie, it's like conflict resolution. Like, Adam Sandler has three kids. They're getting older. One of his kids, the middle one, is getting picked on by a bully. At the end of the movie, like, there's one scene of that. And at the end of the movie, they become friends. Conflict resolution. You know, I can't even begin to tell you, to give you a context of how brilliant this movie is in its shittiness, how they try to just go all out with the terribleness of this movie. It ends in a Braveheart, kind of Dark Knight Rises, Lord of the Rings battle between what is seemingly the entire population of the town against the snobby frat boys. And apparently, it's like thousands of them. Thousands of snobby frat boys led by Taylor Lautner. And they charge at each other. And all these people are fighting each other hand-on-hand combat. What the fuck does this have to do with Adam Sandler's comedies? They don't know. They don't care. Adam Sandler and Dennis Dugan probably saw, like, they went to the IMAX and saw Dark Knight Rises, and, like, Dennis Dugan said, I cannot do that. And he probably thought, like, suck my dick, Chris. You know, it's just, like, it's incredible they do this stuff. I'm waiting for someone to cut that. I mean, like, when Adam Sandler and Taylor Lautner finally meet, it is like that moment in Dark Knight Rises where the camera pulls up and, like, you know, it pulls up on Batman and, like, Bane is slowly walking up towards him. They start swinging at each other again. Like, it is like that. Like, so, you've come to die for your city. Like, it's that
moment. You fight like a young man.
Why am I still... I still love doing impressions. Fuck you guys if you don't like it. I'm still like doing it. I'm sorry.
There's so many things. I mean, it's just terrible. I mean, it's... Oh, my God. I can't even describe it. Like, we could do, like, an entire, like, film discussion study on this movie. On all of the jokes that don't work, but it doesn't matter.
Like, at one point, they go inside a Kmart, and my comment to my... I saw it by myself. I was thinking to myself, like, that... This is clearly... Yeah, I couldn't convince anybody to go. No, but it's like, it was clearly, like, movie reality, because, like, I've never been to a Kmart that clean or nice that was, like, well-stocked. And, like, this one is movie reality. Like, everyone hangs out at the Kmart, apparently. That's the thing they do in the small town, you know. Does anybody have questions? Gabe saw it, too, actually. He texted me.
Shh, don't tell anyone.
Yeah, we accepted it out of his mind. Like, he... I had...
Adam Sandler cannot resist corporate tie-ins, and it's to the point where it's, like, legitimately really gross.
Yeah.
It's just kind of, you know, any soft drink, any brand, anything like that. I mean, that's my boy, you know. If you go back to that, his character is a hardcore alcoholic, quotation marks, who loves drinking Bud Light and... goes everywhere trying to make WhatsApp happen again, you know, which, you know, I don't know what Bud Light paid him for that, but...
It's not even good beer. I mean, come on.
Well, obviously. I mean, Pitbull's a spokesman, but, you know, it's just Sandler's commercial instincts. He has movies where characters sing jingles to certain products, and they take a bite of something, and they say, "Wow, this is really terrific. Have you had it?" You know, it's kind of, you know, it's more of the same. And Kmart, just this whole, you know, they spend a lot of time in Kmart, and it's really only one day, but they cut away and they cut back, and they're still there. They're just hanging out, which I've seen Kmart mega stores like this, and they're horrifying. Not just Kmart, but, you know,
oh, yes,
these mega stores where you can get anything that they have there, and it's just a cesspool.
It's like George Romero made this movie all of a sudden. If only.
Yeah, they, you know, this is a Kmart. They go in there. I guess they're looking for certain things, but it's like they're just hanging out.
Yeah.
And just chilling out and relaxing and sitting there in the Kmart, and I'm waiting for an employee to come by and say, "Do you guys mind? Could you not?
Gentlemen, are you going to buy something? You know?
Could you maybe shop here? You know?"
I will say that not in my hometown, but like my parents' hometown, I have cousins that still live there, and the fun thing they do on Friday nights is go to Dollar General, so I can believe that people would hang out at a Kmart.
Yeah, yeah, no, it makes sense, but it's also...
It's also very corporate. Yes.
It's very corporate, yeah. But we go to movies to escape. Like, we want to relate to a character in a certain way. And it's like, we don't want to do, like, what's the highlight of their Friday night? Let's go to Kmart. Like, that's... I don't want to see that in my movies. Like, I want to see characters who realistically interact with each other, and that's something that, to this movie's strange credit, they did, at least the first one. But I don't want to see him go to fucking Kmart for 40 minutes.
At least go to the Walmart. It seems cozier in there.
And I tell you, in terms of acting performances, it's strange that Shaquille O'Neal was the best actor in the movie.
Awesome. That is.
And yeah, it's like, you know, he's the brother of, what's his name, the guy from...
Tim Meadows.
Tim Meadows, thank you. It's like, you know they're brothers because they both have the same bald cap. That's how they convey it visually. And, like, this movie also defies logic. Like, it just makes no sense. Like, suddenly, like, Shaquille O'Neal, because he's big, he can throw a character literally across, like, the yard. And he's on, like, he does. He throws him, and, like, he throws one
and
of the bad guys.
He throws him over the house.
Over the house into, like, the beach, yeah, the guest house.
Literally over the house.
Makes no sense. It's just, it doesn't matter. Defies logic for the moment. Yeah, I know.
That sounds hilarious. I'm not going to lie. That does sound very funny.
And, like, Tim Meadows has a son, and, like, his son wants to date Chris Rock's daughter. And, of course, we know it's his son because he's got a bald cap on. But he also has, like, he looks like Mr. Jefferson, you know, from the Jeffersons.
He's Humpty Hump.
Yeah, if he had sex with Urkel. Like, that's what his son looks like. And, you know, he goes, "What?" He does that a lot. "What?" And then at the end of the movie when they have the big 80s party, like, Tim Meadows and his son show up. And, like, there's his wife, played by some other SNL alum whose name escapes
me. Ellen Cleghorn.
Thank you, Gabe. He is here with the Encyclopedia of Knowledge. Thank you, sir. You see, we find out she's got the bad nose makeup and the thick glasses and not the bald cap, strangely. And you know what she says? "What?" Like, see, that's where they get it from. It's a joke, see? Again, conflict resolution. It's just
you
like
explain this very thoroughly. I don't think it's.
I took notes. I was like, this shit.
You know, the thing that's interesting about me, about my feelings about these Sandler films. I've seen a lot of them. I actually grew up watching those SNL episodes and that generation from late 80s to. I still watch it today, you know, I still watch it pretty, you know, extensively. And this film is loaded with people from Saturday Night Live, particularly people that you haven't seen in years, like Ellen Klugman. And,
Is she the one that was obsessed with Sandler?
No, that's Cherry-O-Terry.
Okay.
Also an SNL, who hasn't been seen in anything for a while. But, the fact is that Sandler, you know,
He's loyal.
He's loyal and he keeps his friends together. And these are really fun. You know, Saturday Night Live is a really hardcore place. You know, tons of people that haven't made it on Saturday Night Live are really funny people. Chris Rock was relegated to crappy stuff on Saturday Night Live for like 3 years. And he's a hilarious guy. But you know, they treated him like you know, they're not really nice to black people on Saturday Night Live. But, you know, the interesting thing, and I don't know what this is a problem or not, is that Sandler trusts these people and he gives jobs to all these guys, but he also gives jobs to people that aren't comedians, like you know, people like, and that's my boy Tony Orlando and Vanilla Ice, and this film Shaquille O'Neal and Taylor Lautner, just these non-actors.
I got your joke there.
I wasn't joking.
No, you said Taylor Lautner. No, the joke is Taylor Lautner is not an actor. He's like, no, I'm not joking.
Is that a joke? the just the fact that he brings these people in to like kind of, but he lowers the quality of comedy discourse so that these guys could catch up and clown around with like John Lovitz, who's been doing comedy for decades.
That's you right. Can't, like, John Lovitz is match, in this movie.
Yeah, that was humiliating.
But you can't bring him wasn't in. It? Oh,
it really was. But you can't like bring him in and just have him play off of like Maria Bello. Maria Bello, who's a fantastic actress, but it's like, oh,
she's
Maria
in
Bello,
this?
Yeah, she's in the first one. No? She's Kevin James's wife, which yet again the reality of movies. It's like I can believe a lot of things, but
she's not in this, right?
No, she's in. Oh, you didn't see the trailer? Like, it's one of the set pieces of the movie is the homophobia of the car wash, which is you know, I don't like to make accusations, and a lot of people make them, and I'm like, ah, it's unfounded, it's bullshit, it's the movie. But this is clearly like Adam Sandler. I don't think Adam Sandler's homophobic, but I think he's playing to he knows his movies are very popular in flyover country, so it's like let's do every gay stereotype imaginable, like you know. But then he thinks it's okay because then he has one character who says, by the way, I'm gay, and, you know, but he's okay. I'm sorry. Gabe, go ahead.
Yeah. I want to touch on that point before, which that is kind of a double take when people hear, oh, Kevin James is married to Maria Bello, and no one says a thing about it. You know, that's kind of interesting as far as the matchups. What I find I found it kind of questionable, and now I find it kind of appalling, the idea of two straight films where Adam Sandler's married to Salma Hayek. And let me say something about Salma Hayek. Salma Hayek is, I really feel like she's an underlooked actress. I think she's one of the better actresses of her generation. I think she's a wonderful personality. I think she's very talented. She's done comedy. She's done drama. She's a figure of world cinema. She does a lot of Spanish language films. You know, she's a significant person in world cinema. She spreads culture to a lot of people. And she's obviously one of the most beautiful women in the world. My God, you know, you can't take your eyes off her when she's on the screen, no matter what she's in. This movie ends with a joke about Adam Sandler farting on her.
That's right.
That is so disgraceful and offensive. That's beyond acceptable. That's just like... You know, this is what our film culture is right here. You know, Adam Sandler farting on Salma Hayek. Salma Hayek served on the jury at Cannes, and no one gives a shit because here she is in a movie that made like $50 million this weekend, being farted on by Adam frickin' Sandler. Yeah, there's a fine line between a bunch of good old boys. Messing around
Yeah.
And then a movie where you're actively hostile towards the female characters, where they're being gawked at. There's the Pilates scene or whatever where they're all being gawked at, like, oh, boobies, wow, they're going to shake, whatever. And there's a couple moments like that. There's Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin, who is also in this movie.
Yes, that's right.
Has a girlfriend who her purpose in the narrative is to be gawked at and objectified. And then you have this movie ending with the hilarity of Salma Hayek being farted on. You know, and these aren't just, you know, nobody actresses. Maya Rudolph is in this, and she's married to Chris Rock in the film. She's a brilliantly talented comedian. You have Maria Bello, who I believe was nominated for an Oscar a couple times. Maybe once.
But she was also in The Mummy 3, so just don't forget.
She had to pay the bills, you know.
And Mummy 3 is a nice, you know, paycheck. But she was nominated for either The Cooler or History of Violence. But regardless, she's great in both. And, you know, there's Salma Hayek there, and things don't seem equal in this case. And, you know, this is the kind of movie where the first film had a quote-unquote memorable gag about somebody peeing in the pool.
Yes.
And how it gives off a certain
That's right,
liquid.
There's a callback joke to that, yeah.
Yeah, and they felt the need to say, you know, we need to resurrect the parts of the first film that people like the best. So let's do the same peeing joke again, because that's the mentality of the audience. It's an active contempt for the audience, and it's an active hostility towards the women. And that happened in my screening, and then the credits come up, and the audience starts applauding, and I almost couldn't breathe. Like, no joking aside, that's just it's horrifying, and it's like, it's heartbreaking, and it really kind of hurts that movies would get to that point. You know, you love movies so much, and you see something like that, and people just say, I love this. And it's so profane in a way in which, you know, I feel like Tommy Lee Jones in No Country for Old Men.
I'm sorry.
You know, it actively hurts to, you know, to see this, and, you know, you see the devil. You see the devil and you say, I'd rather not. You know,
the
not
devil,
today.
You've seen the devil, and you know what he sounds like this. it's
horrifying. You know, this
he's
is
got
how,
the Adam Sandler voice. That's the one thing this movie didn't have, actually. He doesn't do that voice. I don't know if he's done it in a while. Although he does yell at a child at one point. Because he always has to have that scene where he goes, like a Neanderthal. I mean, look, I get why this movie made a lot of money, and I'm not going to be snobby about it, because, frankly, it was better marketed. That comes down to the marketing people. Like, everyone wants to bitch and scream and holler and hold their breath because it did better than Pacific Rim. But it's like, that movie went to everybody. Pacific Rim only fucking sold itself to the geeks. You can't, like, cannot expect people to get into, to go see something that's not even sold to them. But, yeah, it's a piece of shit, so.
No, I can't get people off the hook for seeing something that's so borderline un-American. The first film is a landfill of a movie.
It's a series of scenes put together.
Yeah, and this film is even less of a movie. It is an anti-movie. You know, why would you see the first film and say, yeah, why not? You know, sign up for another one. Movie tickets are already so expensive. I don't want to hear the complaining of people who say, you know, more people will be going to the movies if the movie's ready. Good, man.
Okay, who is that?
You just put your money where your mouth is, right there. You just did it. You know, maybe there's a serious complaint about how movies are being made and the system needs to be overhauled, but it's not an issue of quality. If you have movies like this, not only being successful, but getting a free pass, this should be booed out of theaters. This should be boycotted. And not because it's... The only thing offensive here is just the bad taste of bad taste. You know, I wanted to say, like, oh, these are the worst movies of the year. This is, you know, the worst movie I've seen in a while, whatever. This is not a movie. This does not deserve to be called a movie. I don't know what this is.
It's an experience, I think.
And the fact that these people millions of dollars to do this shit, and then people pay $12 a pop to go watch Salma Hayek get farted on. What is the society that we think this is okay? I don't want to talk to family members who've seen this shit, you know? I mean, it's beyond acceptable. It's not even funny anymore. It's, you know, there needs to be, something needs to happen. You know, I don't know. I see a movie like this and I just think, you know, we need to burn everything down.
It's okay. Gabe has had, he's seen too many. See, maybe part of the perspective of me is that I don't watch Adam Sandler movies. Like, I watch Jack and Jill
as an experiment for the podcast 2 years ago. And this is true, Phil. I did. And I was like, wow, it's really terrible.
And let me tell you, folks, there was no funnier moment up until this show that when Jamie explained the Johnny Depp cameo scene. You are trying to delay as much as you can the inevitable moment that you have to talk about the other film that you saw. Even Nate admits that you saw the other film.
I don't have a problem admitting that, because we do a podcast called Movie Bone. That means seeing movies and complaining or not complaining about them. So I have to, in the good of my heart, watch this fucking movie. Yes, I saw Jack and Jill. Go ahead and ask me questions. What else is there to say? I saw it. There is one thing, though. I did not say it. I wanted to hold it off air to get everyone's first reaction. I knew this was coming because someone spoiled it to me, but it was still astounding. Fucking Johnny Depp's in this movie!
Mr. Secretary! Mr. Secretary, sir.
They found Johnny Depp's cameo. It's in Jack and Jill. So where's the Johnny we love? I think we have to accept the possibility that Johnny Depp doesn't give a shit anymore.
Are you serious right now?
By the hand of Jeebus, I swear to God, Johnny Depp is in this movie as himself.
You know what?
I think we should cut to a shot of Hicks just saying game over at this point.
But let's mark the date. What's the date?
November 13th, dear.
November 13th, 2011 is the day that I've officially washed my hands of Johnny Depp. It's over. He no longer gives me a girl boner. It's done.
It's astounding to see Johnny Depp in this goddamn movie.
I need to know. Describe the context of this scene.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so it's the scene where they go to the basketball game, and there's Al Pacino, and he's in disguise, and he's sitting next to Johnny Depp. And, like, you know, you go to these basketball games, they got the big, like, you know, couples cam, kissing cam. They say celebrity cam, and they're focusing on Al Pacino wearing a bad fake beard. And I'm sitting there going, I literally said out loud, oh, yeah, like, they wouldn't notice Johnny Depp sitting next to Al Pacino. Like, they would really focus on him instead of Johnny Depp.
Okay. I have not seen this movie clearly. I never will, but...
You should.
Fuck you.
But see, it's so funny because Adam Sandler is playing a woman. And he's he really committed to this part. I heard he put on a wig and some makeup and did a funny voice once or twice. That's his role.
I'm telling you,
it's Shaquille O'Neal's in it and Regis Philbin's in it. I mean, it is the modern day cavalcade of stars, man. I mean, just this is the DuMont Network all over again.
This is like the cinematic version of George W. Bush's Shock and Awe campaign. They might as well have shown this.
That's right.
There are not enough bombs in the world that would shock me as much as when you said that Johnny Depp is in this movie.
Oh, but it gets better.
Isn't it true that he's wearing a Justin Bieber shirt in this? I had read that.
I think he is. I didn't notice the shirt. I was
God!
Are you
fucking me? Oh, no! Jesus Christ!
But I think the joke is, like, she doesn't recognize Johnny Depp, and she goes, oh, yeah, weren't you in Duran Duran? And he just is very nice, and he goes, yes, I was. See, it's funny because he wasn't.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, I've had to review all the last few Sandler films, so I've seen all of them.
I'm sorry.
And,
have you been doing a retrospective or something?
it's like watching a toilet slowly flush. And, you know, what I think is interesting about Jack and Jill and That's My Boy is that those films were considered failures financially Sandler's career. And Grown Ups and Grown Ups 2 are both, you know, very big hits. And the vibe that I got from Jack and Jill and That's My Boy was that these are very bad films, but Sandler is actually, in both of them, he's actually giving a legit performance, which, again, shows the limitations of his range and talent, but, you know, he's trying very hard. So he looks at these other films, you know, and he looks at Funny People, and then he looks at the two Grown Ups, and he says, you know what? When I try, bad things happen. When I fart on Salma Hayek, it's okay. we're enabling this, you know? I don't know who's enabling this, but I don't know if I am. I wrote two reviews of the film, you know? I had to write two reviews for two separate outlets. And those reviews get tons of clicks. And those reviews, no matter what I say is negative, those reviews count as promotion.
Right.
I help promote this movie.
You have blood
on
your hands.
And that makes me, you know, that makes me sick, you know? You know, that's the critic's role, you know, that we are here to promote the film, unfortunately. That's just what it is. That's what it is. And in this case, I just, you know...
I'm waiting for someone to do something where, like, maybe not you, Gabe, but someone else. I'm surprised no one's ever done this, but, like, next time an Adam Sandler movie comes out, like, promote it like, you know, like the big review. Like, Gabe is reviewing Adam Sandler's, you know, Spencer just said on here, Grown Ups 3 Babies, you know. So, like, you know, you click on the article, and it's literally a blank page. That's it. Like, no description, just a blank page. And everyone can be like, Did the server crash? Did something happen? Did, like, the text get wiped? And don't even explain it. Just leave it blank. Just don't say a word. And see if anybody notices. And then, yeah, see the comments section fill up with, I disagree, I thought it was awesome. Because the way people, they fill in, they try to see shit that isn't there. It's an interesting experiment that you should try sometime, Gabe.
I'm sorry, I missed a lot of that. The voices kind of came in really loud. I'm getting a lot of feedback from like 7 ads, and it's a nightmare.
News! We'll try and close on a bit of a high note, I don't know how. I would just like to mention very briefly in the news, we'll just click off a couple of things and, you know, hopefully Gabe will be okay. Number one is that we got the Electro picture this week. Now, usually we don't normally talk anymore about picks of characters, especially characters in comic book movies, because you always hear the same things. Well, it doesn't look very good, or it looks really, really stupid, and how are they going to do this, and I hate Spider-Man, yada, 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 yada. But I thought this one was interesting because, first of all, I really dig it. I really dig it a lot. This is a side profile one I'm talking about. There's another one that came out in the article where he's got like an Elvis snarl going on, which I wasn't too much of a fan of. But the side one I like for a couple of reasons. First of all, when we saw the initial set pictures, you know, everyone was making their cracks about what he was compared to. I called him a frost giant, I remember. Other people called him Blue Dude. I mean, I remember that some people have called him Powder, which amused me thoroughly.
Wow.
But, yeah, I know. That's enough.
That
I know, before. Right? Yeah, I'd forgotten until they mentioned it. But what's clear from the picture is, to me, his whole innards are going to be pulsating with electricity for the whole movie, which is going to be really, really cool. And also, I love that I made a tweet about this, but it's true. It's the first thing I thought of when I saw it. He's wearing a costume from C-Lab 2020. He's wearing a wetsuit. And it's a wetsuit with an electric sign on the side, on the shoulder pad. And again, I just love the fact that everyone's trying so hard these days to be realistic, to ground these ridiculous characters and make sure there's a rhyme and reason behind everything. And I like the fact that, you know, Spectacular Spider-Man or wherever it's going to be called. I'm still amazed we don't have a proper title on this film yet, by the way. It's less than a year away and we still don't have one. But we have a character and a movie that's not afraid to dress up ridiculous characters in ridiculous costumes. He's called Electro. I assume he will be called that in the film. Yeah, why not wear a wetsuit? I don't know why it's a wetsuit. He can't get wet. He's made of electricity. I'm sure that will be explained somehow, but I thought it was cool. Does anyone else have anything to say about that?
I like the little sidebar he has, like, on his head, as if, like, he's been purchased. You know, he wanted to go to, like, the Kmart just to buy him because he was on sale, and I had to have the barcode just to take him home with me. Like, that was kind of a cool little twist. But, I mean, Amazing Spider-Man 2 is just, like, what do they end up calling it? Like, it's just, once we see footage, I'll get an idea. But that's about it. To me, the next discussion is, like, box office related, which we have another year to do that. And it
will be interesting when once we get closer to that. But in terms of quality, I'm like, eh, whatever. I'm not going to complain about it because it is what it is at this point. And people have made it very clear to Phil and me, we're tired of hearing you talk about those movies.
So unless, see, Jamie, no, this is a problem. No, they're tired of hearing us talk negatively. But if we talk positively, that's okay.
Hmm. Interesting.
Mm. Well, that's how it works with people that visit our websites.
That's true.
That's like the response to my Pacific Rim review was the most positive things I've ever read on the website. But then, you know, my negative reviews of, like, The Lone Ranger or whatever else I've given a bad review, like World War Z, everyone, you know, just shredding me for being an idiot.
That's right. You have a mixed review to Man of Steel, and everyone just said, like, you were a cocksucker or something. All of a
sudden. Did they? I didn't read the comments on that
one. Sure, well, I'm sure they did, but you did give it a
thanks
mixed
for telling me, Jamie.
That was me.
Honest to God, no tact. No tact sometimes. But also on a lovely note, and this relates to Spencer because we've been talking on Twitter this week. Last week, Jamie and I were talking about holiday plans. God knows why you were interested, but you seemed to like the video we did, so we thought we'd let you in on when are we going to meet? When is Jamie going to come to me? And we talked about a couple of movies. I didn't mention it last week, but I thought if we did next year, the obvious choice for me would be Brad Bird's Tomorrowland. I would love to see that with Jamie. That would be wonderful. It doesn't relate to anything. It's not personally connected to us, but I would love to do that. But that doesn't give Jamie enough time to save money for a London trip. Things are expensive these days, and I'm going to expect him to pay for everything. So I'm going to give him another year, late October, last week of October 2015. It is confirmed that we are getting Bond 24 or Bond 4. The next one, the Thunderball, the Moonraker, or the Die Another Day of the Daniel Craig series. And before you say, Phil, how can you say that? I could be wrong, but I found a very interesting effect with the Bond movies, with the actors who actually managed to make multiple films. There is a definite correlation here. There is a definite correlation between Connery's third, Goldfinger, Moore's third, Spy Who Loved Me, and, well, not The World's Not Enough, but definitely Craig's third, Skyfall. You have the one that is unbelievably successful to the point where you can't even quantify it, and for the most part everybody loves it, and then you get the next one following on from that which desperately tries to capture lightning in a bottle again, and somehow it just doesn't hit it. So Connery's fourth was Thunderball, which is a very cold mechanical movie. It's entertaining, god damn it is, but it ain't, it's just not up to snuff. And then you've got Moore's third, fourth, excuse me, which is Moonraker. Yeah. And then you've got Brosnan's fourth, which is Die Another Day. Yeah, that one with the surfing. And then you've got Craig's fourth. And, you know, for people who didn't like Skyfall, I'm sorry to tell you, John Logan's writing it again, and Mendes is back. And I don't know about you, Jamie, but I'm just going to be really, really fascinated to see whether they either do make something which is better next time because Mendes is more comfortable, or they really have, you know, they're smoking their own press, basically, and they just make something which is horrible because they think they can't lose. What do you think's going to happen?
I think in terms of, I mean, I think it's going to be a big extravaganza. I think because Mendes got to do one half of a Bond movie, like the gritty, realistic Bond, the one that's edgy and like Fleming-esque, that they always like to say. And then there's the extravagant spectacle where it's like great big sets on Pinewood, and there's the over-the-top villain, and like there's the henchmen, all those the one-liners and stuff. And granted, some of that stuff was in Skyfall, but I feel like they're going to go all out Spy Love Me on this one. I feel like because it's the only other way to go. Is the spectacle Bond, which we haven't necessarily gotten from the Craig movies. Let me rephrase that. There have been spectacle fantasy Bond, which I don't like one bit, but I feel like that's what they're going to do.
Well, I certainly think Robert certainly hopes that they're going to do that. I mean, why the hell not? Why not try it? You don't know if it's going to work with Craig until you try it. And it makes sense, doesn't it? It does make sense that that's the only way you're going to top in terms of box office, which is, sounds impossible all by itself anyway, that you could actually do even better than Skyfall. But who the hell knows at this point? All bets are off. All I know is that it's wonderful, with all the trials and tribulations that life throws at us, that I now have in 2 years and a bit, two and change, something amazing to look forward to. Not that there's another Bond film, but that Jamie is, as long as he can save the money, going to come over to London. We're going to experience it together. And are we going to film it? You bet your ass.
Shit,
yeah. Yes, you.
I'll have to buy some pants instead of some shorts, you know. I'll be the one guy in shorts.
It's going to be like that scene in Man of Steel where Superman keels over and vomits on Zod's ship. You've never gone to London, so you're not used to our atmosphere.
Yeah, and Zod's just like, I can't help him. Who fucking cares?
But that's kind
of the best performance of Shannon at that moment was him just so just nonchalant, like, I cannot help him. Anyway, what do you guys want to eat? You know.
But anyway, we want Spencer to come too. I did mention this. Everybody who meets me gets a gift, so I'd love you to come, Spencer, if you want to start saving now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Awesome!
Oh, I just realized that it comes out in the UK 2 days after my birthday.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
Well, you know what, Spencer? I didn't say we had to just meet up on the day. If you come there 2 days before, I promise you, I will give you a British birthday bash you will never forget.
I'm so down for that.
That is my mark of honor as a G. I will make sure that happens. That will be awesome.
There are so many British shows that I love that I could be the new Jamie if Phil decides to kick you off.
Wow. Sharp as knives there, buddy.
Well, I disagree with the terminology then. It's not if, it's when. And it's not too far off. Gabe, just to cheer him up, we're going to let Gabe end the show. Cause Gabe has one more movie that he wants to talk about. What do you want to talk about, sir?
Yeah, next weekend is July 19th, and Hollywood is releasing four new films, R.I.P.D., The Conjuring, Turbo, and Red 2, which, you know, collectively pretty much is like, well, you know, no wonder the industry is dying. But there are three very small films that are coming out that are really interesting, and I wish it wasn't sort of, you know, this huge, you know, sometimes there's these dates where they just cram all this interesting smaller pictures together and you're screwed if you're in a major area where they're playing or if they're on VOD or whatever. But there are three movies coming out next week. There's one I want to concentrate on, but the three that they're all really interesting. One is Only God Forgives, the new Nicholas Winding Refn film, which is a very intense, very unusual picture. To me, it kind of felt very Kubrickian almost, which of course means that no one will watch it because it's Kubrickian plus half of it's in Thai, and Ryan Gosling has less lines in this than he does in Drive. So, you know, box office success. But you know, it's disappointing because I watch this movie and there are two things I think, you know, which is one, you know, it's what an awesome singular experience, and two, this is, you know, Refn was so hot after Drive, which made a decent amount of money and became talked about by a lot of people. And this is a complete journey into esoterica, you know? So I'm very hopeful that people will seek that out. The second film that's coming out that's really interesting is a documentary called The Act of Killing. Draft House Releasing is putting this out. And they've put out a lot of really interesting stuff. And this is a documentary about the massacres in it's about these multiple generations of massacres in Indonesia. And just now, it's basically there was an uprising and it was quelled and the gangsters won. And it's decades later. The gangsters pretty much rule. They walk the streets and they're like Hollywood superstars. And this documentary is about the after effect of that and how these people kind of learn about what they did. They think it's a good thing. You know, they liberated these people. They murdered hundreds of people. And the crew decides to help them make a film that dramatizes their own experiences. And they think, oh, it's going to be like a Scarface sort of thing. Tons of fun, awesome. We're going to look great. And they're playing themselves. And it's a really upsetting, interesting, it's fascinating documentary. It's produced by Werner Herzog and Errol Morris.
Whoa.
Which is a pretty impressive lineup for that sort of thing. It is a surreal, bizarre, it's like nothing you've ever seen before. Very surreal, bizarre, and truly upsetting movie. But the one movie I want to talk about that comes out next weekend, and I might be all alone on this, and I feel like most people who heard about this immediately turned off their brain. They said, hell no. It's a micro tiny movie called Computer Chess. Already, you know, you're already somebody just said, fuck it, I don't care. But this is a picture from Andrew Bujalski, who's credited with inventing the mumblecore movement, which again, eye rolls everywhere. A lot of people hate the mumblecore movement. This is a movie about the early 80s, about a group of computer programmers who hole up in a hotel for a weekend for like a symposium, basically, where they're designing, developing computers to develop the ability to play chess and to become chess masters, you know? So essentially the early days of artificial intelligence. What's interesting is that this movie, which has no stars whatsoever, no familiar faces, even non-actors, this movie is shot in black and white using cameras from that era, using 1970s cameras.
Oh, that's cool.
On video. This is shot on video circa 1970s, 1980s. The movie takes place in 1980. You know, so it looks like cable access of like early 80s. And I sat down, and I get like this sometimes, a little bit snobby about the experience, because I sat down watching this movie. I watched the first 10 minutes and I'm like, shit, who, I'm in New York City. Who plunked down $14 to watch this shit, you know? It looks terrible, you know? It looks beat up and everybody's ugly. You know, these are nerds. You know, this is not Hollywood nerds. These are nerds, you know? And eventually I went through, I watched the films about 90 to 100 minutes, something like that. And it was the most fun I've had in a movie theater all year. And this is in between Pacific Rims and, you know, Explosion Fest, whatever, big action movies. This little movie with no stars in black and white shot on 1970s video that maybe two people will ever watch. And I'm not sure what kind of release it's getting, but it's tons of fun. It's funny as hell. You know, it's very real. It's about the interplay between these guys and how they're developing these computers and the tension. And there's a little bit of Cold War tension because, you know, they're developing technology and everybody's like, oh, the CIA is right behind our backs, whatever. And no one really wants to acknowledge that they're in just like a shitty motel. And there's one guy who's just hanging out. He's like a groupie. There's one groupie. This whole event, and he's just this big, sweaty, fat guy who doesn't know computers, and he's just there to spread like conspiracy theories and shit like that. And there's one guy who didn't even rent a room for the weekend, so he just tries to sleep at other people's beds, and he's a kleptomaniac, and he's an asshole, and he's just wandering the halls all night, and everyone just assumes he has a room. And you know, I don't know, I can describe it, I don't know, but it's funny, it's human, it's not over the top, it's very, very, very low budget. You know, it's that mumblecore type of thing that people talk about. But these are nerds, you know. Mumblecore, they invented mumblecore, you know what I'm saying? These are guys that are born mumblecore, you know? They are inarticulate nerds who, you know, when you look at this film from a historical perspective, how they developed AI, they kind of built the blueprint for the modern world, you know? Which the movie doesn't touch on that. It's just kind of left for you to make that assumption. But I thought it was a really beautiful, really unique, really sweet and funny and bizarre movie, you know. And I think there's got to be a way this gets out to other people. So July 19th, there are four really shitty-sounding piece of crap Hollywood films you can see. And there are three really interesting indie films. I'm not sure which one of them is on VOD for people who aren't in major metro cities. But I think Only God Forgives might be. But I think you need to do everything, whoever's listening to this, you need to do everything in your power to see these three movies and to ignore those other four, please. Particularly ignore those other four, you know, and anything else that's playing right now. You know, I don't like to be the guy who's like, studio's bad, indie's good. But these are three really unique, really interesting, distinct movies. Coming out on the same day as Red 2.
I think on a week like this, you can say that, Gabe. I don't think anyone's going to begrudge you.
That movie sounds really good, actually. You had me at the way they shot it.
Yeah, it sounds lovely.
It sounds like, you know what it is? It sounds like then like what Michael Mann tried to pull off with Public Enemies and failed miserably.
Bujaski was giving an interview, which I thought was funny. He said he shot on film with these super ultra-low-budget films. He's made a few already.
Yeah.
And somebody was like, why don't you shoot on video? You shoot on video. And he's like, that's a great idea. I'll shoot on 1970s quality video. Brilliant. You know, and he used the shittiest looking, it literally looks like cable access.
Uh-huh.
You know, it looks below trash humpers quality at certain points. But this guy, he's a real filmmaker. You know, I've seen all of his work, and this is the first one where he announces himself as a, not just a solid or interesting storyteller, or an interesting filmmaker, but a great one.
Wow. That being said, Jamie lives in the swamps, so won't have a choice but to see one of those shitty ones. So, what, Jamie, if you, I'm not assuming that you are, but if you have to make a choice next weekend, what are you going to put your money on?
The Conjuring, easily.
Oh.
I've heard great buzz about that. That's going to open big next weekend. That is the only interesting looking film that's coming out next weekend anyway. At least in terms of the four wide releases. Turbo and RIPD are dead on arrival, and it's not just because Ryan Reynolds starred in it, they just look terrible. RIPD would be fun just to like watch it in a bad movie sense, but I feel like it's not going to be so bad it's good, it's just going to be so bad it's really fucking bad.
RIPD is screening for critics on Thursday night.
That's right, I forgot about
Jesus
that.
Jesus Christ.
That made me a little more excited.
Yeah, it's tracking at $15 million. I think it will personally do about $1 million. So I feel like that's a 30 Rock joke. Carrie Fisher's like, opening weekend box office, $1 million.
It sounds funny. $1 million sounds funny.
I feel like that's what this is. I mean, it's like, again, like, you know, Gabe and I keep making the joke, but this literally looks like it was made in 1998, and they just, like, put it in a time capsule, and then they dug it up. Whoever is working at Universal now, and they're like, hey, like, we need to put some out in July.
No.
They're hiding everyone in this movie, too. I mean, that's the other thing. Not only like are we not seeing the money being spent on RIPD, we're not seeing half the cast. Like, we know that Ryan Reynolds is in it. We know that Jeff Bridges is in it.
I'm in it.
We know that you're in it, and we know that Mary Louise Parker's in it. James Wong's in it. We know he's in it, right?
So well, you act like that cocaine's going to snort itself.
And on that bombshell, that is a wrap for tonight. I get The World's End next weekend. Aren't I lucky? I actually get a nice choice there. And then the weekend after that, of course, we've been hearing Wolverine's good. So we've got The Wolverine Show, and I'm actually now genuinely looking forward to it. And after that, the summer's kind of over, and it's sad. But we've still got to deal with fucking Kick-Ass 2 and Elysium. That is true. Positivity. Thank you very much, Jamie. But we've still got things to go, so stay with us. It's going to be fun. We really hope you enjoyed this show. It did not go the way I thought it was going to, but when do they ever? But this was absolutely delightful. So first of all, Gabe, thank you so much for being on the couch tonight.
Thank you.
Spencer, a pleasure as always, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad this is the first movie mode I've been on where everyone had differing opinions about the film. Everyone else I've been on, it's either everyone loved it or everyone hated it.
Really?
And yet we're
yeah, because still... Pain Gain, it was me and you, and we both loved it. And
that's
then,
right.
What was the other one?
There
was another one we did, and we all hated it.
Star Trek. That one. Right. That proves a point. He can't even remember that he saw it. That proves something right there. And isn't it nice that one of those shows where we all debated, and yet we're all still friends at the end? Something to
speak for yourself.
Yeah, I know, right?